KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee and other Republicans are pushing back against the Trump administration's DEI purge of Native Americans, quite literally, from federal government websites. Correspondent Nikolai Butler reports from Washington that even members of the president's own party are aghast at efforts to erase First Americans from government websites.
Republicans in Congress are behind most of President Donald Trump's efforts to reshape Washington in his own image. But even his GOP allies say Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, team crossed the line by literally erasing the term Native American from some government sites.
I don't know why you just do that as a matter of course.
I hadn't seen that.
No.
I have no idea.
Wait, I don't understand the question.
That's Republican U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, James Langford of Oklahoma, and Kevin Cramer of North Dakota. They're angry web pages honoring Navajo code talkers were deleted at the Pentagon. The administration restored the pages, calling it a mistake, but the mistakes don't stop there.
If it's Native American, it's Native American.
Senator Cramer of North Dakota's no fan of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, but he says the administration went too far.
I don't know. I mean, it seems weird. I don't know why you do that. But first thing I do is check with local Native people to see what their preference is, because some of them don't like it.
Senate Indian Affairs Committee Chair Lisa Murkowski has been leaning on Interior Department and Health and Human Services officials to ensure tribal programs aren't caught up in this DEI purge.
That was why it was important to get some assurance, some confirmation that when it came to tribes and tribal programs, they were not going to be subject to this DEI initiative. We got that assurance through Interior. We got it through HHS.
But Murkowski says other federal agencies have some catching up to do.
We're seeing this in other accounts, which is troubling. We've reached out to address this because it's not the way it should be.
It's not the way it should be.
Alaska's other senator, Dan Sullivan, calls the erasure of tribal references a huge misstep. The Republicans suggest Musk and his DOGE team are in need of a history lesson.
Tribes and Native Americans are in the Constitution. Maybe some people should go reread their Constitution.
For National Native News, Nikolai Butler in Washington.
The search for a missing Grand Ronde tribal elder continued over the weekend. 63-year-old Jonathan House disappeared in mid-March after leaving a crashed truck in the Coast Range foothills west of Junction City. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, prospects are dim that House is still alive.
House was said to be upset when he drove off from home, and flyers say he sounded distressed in his last call to his partner on March 15th. This weekend, teams of the Lane County Sheriff's Office and the MMIW Search and Hope Alliance searched around Dancing Deer Mountain. Bill Bernard covered almost 800 acres with his drone.
The sheriff's office was kind enough to share coordinates of the last cell phone ping. Unfortunately, that indicated that he didn't progress towards town or towards a road. It actually indicated that he headed deeper into the forest.
We're not going to stop looking for him. He's out there somewhere.
Kim Linning organized the volunteer search. Given the time and elements, she knows it's looking dire for House.
We're looking for his body, his remains. The family is very understanding and thankful and really great.
Anyone with information on House is asked to call the Lane County Sheriff's Office. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We're wasting tons of money on keeping a child in the most expensive possible placement.
The State House passes a bill that would limit time for foster youth in psychiatric facilities. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 31st. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, rural advocates in Alaska worry about an executive order aimed at reshaping federal elections.
It's just not fair, right? I mean, to exclude an entire population because of where they live in the country.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The State House passed a bill last week that would help protect foster kids from unnecessary stays in acute psychiatric care facilities. If it becomes law, a court hearing will be required within 7 days of entering a facility to determine if the placement is necessary instead of 30 days currently. Kids in foster care worked on the legislation and say it's long overdue. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more.
Tali Stone was 9 years old when her foster mother brought her to North Star, an acute psychiatric facility in Anchorage. Stone says she'd been refusing to go to bed and got in a fight with her foster mom. She says her foster mom had talked about North Star before as a threat sometimes if one of her 9 foster kids wasn't behaving.
She always described it to me as a prison. She said that they'll lock you up. She said that it was like moldy inside the building, like an actual prison.
But this time, it wasn't an empty threat. Typically, to be admitted to a psychiatric facility, someone needs to be at risk of suicide or violence, experiencing psychosis, or unable to care for themselves. Stone says during the intake, her foster mom exaggerated her behavior and lied that she was seeing ghosts.
Even the staff said themselves, "I'm not sure why you're here." And I was like, "I'm not sure either."
Stone was at North Star for 4 weeks, according to her psychiatric records. And over the next 2 years, she was admitted to North Star a total of 4 times, each of them several weeks at a time. Stone is one of the thousands of kids under the care of the Office of Children's Services in Alaska, or OCS, who have spent time, sometimes unnecessarily, in acute psychiatric facilities. OCS is under-resourced with a high staff turnover rate and a serious shortage of foster families. The Department of Justice reprimanded the state in 2022 for over-reliance on psychiatric hospitals and residential treatment. The office has notably improved since then. OCS officials did not agree to an interview for this story, but Commissioner Kim Koval from the department that oversees OCS wrote over email that there is a lack of appropriate placements nationwide for youth with serious behavioral and emotional challenges. She wrote that they will continue to use, quote, all existing services to the greatest extent possible, unquote, and work towards the least restrictive care settings. But Amanda Mativier, who runs the nonprofit Facing Foster Care, says that lack of placements means foster kids stay in psychiatric facilities for too long.
So they do an intake at a hospital, they get a diagnosis, and then they linger there. Used to be for months on end, but because of court cases, it's now weeks.
Right now, kids have the right to a court hearing within 30 days of admittance, but the bill passed by the State House would reduce that timeline to 7 days. That's still much longer than in many states. Some require a hearing within 72 hours. According to the bill, at the hearing in Alaska, all people invested in the kids' care would have to be there. Birth parents, foster families, tribes, behavioral health providers, and OCS. Every kid over 10 would also have their own lawyer, who could advocate for them being in the least restrictive setting appropriate. State Representative Andrew Gray sponsored the bill. He says there's a lot at stake.
The absolute human rights violation of having your freedoms completely taken away and no one coming to help you. That alone is enough that we have to fix it. But if you want to just look at it from a fiscal perspective, we're wasting tons of money on keeping a child in the most expensive possible placement.
He says inpatient care can cost more than $1,000 a night per kid. The legislation didn't pass last session, when it included a shorter 72-hour time period before a required hearing. But Gray is optimistic it will pass this year. He says it's important kids don't get stuck in these places. Mativie worked with kids in foster care to help draft the bill. She says it would add a sense of urgency to the process of assessing the care.
We need to act quickly on either identifying a higher level of care or a different therapeutic intervention or releasing them.
Tali Stone, who entered North Star at age 9, didn't get that kind of grace. She says she never got a hearing at all to assess whether she should be there. And she says her experience at North Star, totaling about 4 months, changed her from an outgoing kid to one who was reserved and numb.
Because I didn't have anyone else to tell me that you're just a kid. You're just dealing with stuff that's natural. If you're going through this situation, just telling me that I'm not a bad person, that I'm loved, stuff like that.
She says at age 19 now, about 9 years after her last day, she still feels the effects. She struggles with self-esteem and self-hatred. But she recently got a job she loves with coworkers she looks up to. She says she really hopes this bill passes. It now heads to the Senate. She wants foster kids in institutions to know they're not forgotten, and there are people out here looking out for them. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Alaska's U.S. senators have co-sponsored a resolution to keep the U.S. Postal Service an independent agency and not privatize it. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the Postal Service helps bind the nation together and is vital in a state as vast as Alaska. She said weeks ago that she's worried about what changes to the Postal Service could mean for Alaska's bypass mail subsidy.
It is unique to Alaska. And when people are looking for efficiencies, sometimes they just look and say, well, there's not a lot of people there and it costs a lot of money. And so this can go. This is where you need a very strong and united delegation to defend the programs, defend the purposes, and defend the people.
Bypass mail is a postal service program that makes it cheaper to transport pallets of goods from Anchorage and Fairbanks to rural Alaska. The program costs the Postal Service more than $130 million a year. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan cited bypass mail as a key reason he's co-sponsoring the postal resolution. While he's in favor of subsidies for Alaska, Sullivan has also voiced support for the Trump administration's government-slashing initiative known as DOGE, or Department of Government Efficiency, and he's a member of the Senate DOGE caucus. President Trump last Tuesday issued an executive order to reshape U.S. elections. The order, among other things, mandates absentee and mail-in ballots to be received by Election Day. It also requires proof of citizenship for registering to vote in federal elections. As the Alaska Desk's Aliona Nijdzin reports, there's some concern that the changes might disenfranchise voters in rural Alaska Native communities.
Denise Lisick is a poll worker in Dillingham who oversaw early absentee voting there for the last two presidential elections. In 2020, she says it took 10 days after Election Day for the last batch of early voting ballots to get from Dillingham to Anchorage and from Anchorage to the election office in Nome. That's exactly the time that's allowed by state law. She says the new federal voting timeline would be tight for Dillingham and even tighter for smaller villages that need to get their ballots to their hub community first.
It will definitely disenfranchise smaller rural communities.
Lisick says she saw the majority of absentee ballots cast in the week before the election. If early absentee voting goes until the Monday before Election Day, she says it would be impossible to deliver ballots to the election office by the next day. And an earlier cutoff would mean that some residents have less voting time and less time to decide who to vote for. Jackie Ahanachak-Boyer is from Mikoryuk and works for Rural and Indigenous Outreach Program, which focuses on civic engagement. She says the new regulations might lead to a drop in voter turnout for Alaska Native residents. That number has already been declining over the last few decades.
I think it would be pretty devastating to the rural vote.
In Alaska, mailed ballots can be received within 10 days after Election Day if they're postmarked before that date. The timeline is helpful because hundreds of communities, predominantly Alaska Native, are accessible only by air. Rural Alaska Native villages regularly experience challenges during elections. Storms can prevent planes from coming in and out of the villages for days or weeks, and ballots often arrive late, first to villages and then to an election office. With a lack of volunteers, training, and outreach to residents, polling places sometimes open late or don't open at all, and mail-in votes get rejected. Roya Glowin is the president of the First Alaskans Institute. He says the combination of challenges makes it difficult to count votes from the rural Native communities.
It's just not fair, right? I mean, to exclude an entire population because of where they live in the country and to make it difficult for them to participate in this really important process that is a part of our civil liberties.
The executive order also mandates people to show proof of their citizenship, such as a passport or state ID, to register to vote in federal elections. In Alaska, eligible residents are automatically registered to vote when they apply for the PFD. Aglowin says that many Native Alaskans use tribal IDs because there is nowhere in their village or region to get a passport or a state ID. While the State Division of Elections does not track how many residents use tribal IDs to register to vote, Aglowin says even a small number matters.
Any number of voters that you miss in a community makes a big difference.
Last week, State Representative Robin Burke, who represents much of the North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs, reached out to the House Majority Council to ask about the legality of the new rules. Alaska Division of Elections spokesperson Stephen Courage said in an email last week that the division is reviewing the new executive order and will work with the State Department of Law on any potential changes to policies. Although Courage said that at this time, division staff don't know if there will be any impact in Alaska. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a retiring vet in Sitka recalls the time he delivered 13 puppies from a very pregnant dog.
And I look at this thing and it looks like the Hindenburg. I cut to the chase and I said, we're going to do a C-section here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is imposing what it calls unprecedented conservation measures to address declines of Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon, which is currently under review for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act. The department said in an announcement earlier this month that it will be restricting Western Alaska king salmon fisheries, including in Kodiak, Chignik, and Sand Point. Matt Keyes is an area management biologist at Fish and Game's Sand Point office. He says this is the first time the department has used data from one region to trigger management action in another.
And that is unprecedented from managing a fishery based on fish that are not found locally to the systems in the area in which we're harvesting fish.
Sand Point, off the Alaska Peninsula, is in the middle of the management region known as Area M. And although it doesn't have its own king runs, fishermen intercept salmon that migrate through the region. In recent years, Area M's harvest levels have drawn criticism from stakeholders in Western Alaska who argue the fishery reduces local salmon returns. Keyes says genetic sampling shows much of the Chinook harvested in the South Peninsula fishery actually come from the Pacific Northwest. He added that the new management approach reflects a broader effort to distribute conservation burdens more evenly across the regions that encounter Gulf of Alaska Chinook. Recent Chinook-related closures have also taken place elsewhere in the state. Last year, the fleet in the federally managed Central Gulf Pollock fishery, which is mostly based out of Kodiak, voluntarily ended its season when Chinook bycatch reached a specified threshold. Keyes says the department is looking at ways to try to boost Chinook stocks throughout the Gulf and additional measures that could affect other fisheries.
Everyone that's catching fish is going to bear a little bit of that burden, at least in the westward region.
The current planned restrictions apply only to purse seiners and are limited to July. But Keyes says the management plan could evolve based on in-season harvest numbers. Juneau's mayor selected 11 residents to serve on a short-term rental task force. The group's goal is to assess the benefits and downsides of short-term rentals in the housing market and recommend whether they need to be regulated. But all but one member of the task force are homeowners. And as KTOO's Clarice Larson reports, a member of the group is concerned that the lack of perspective from renters could skew its recommendations.
For some people in Juneau, short-term rentals are an opportunity to bring in some extra cash or to make ends meet. But as the number of Airbnbs and VRBOs increases, others feel they're taking away housing desperately needed in the community. City data and different analyses suggest there are likely around 300 to 400 short-term rentals in Juneau, but that number could be even higher. Short-term rentals are largely unregulated in Juneau, but a new city task force is meeting regularly to decide whether there should be some firmer rules in place. But there's a problem with that group, says Assemblymember Alicia Hughes-Scandies. She's the only member out of 11 who rents.
We need to have people affected by the industry, and that would be renters. And that's just, a demographic that sometimes is not represented.
She says the makeup of the task force doesn't fully represent the diversity of Juneau's housing needs. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, about a third of residents are renters in Juneau. That's a starkly different makeup from the task force.
I don't want to suggest that people can't make, you know, really good civic contributions to a place they care about, but it is not marked by that sense of urgency because they're not affected in the same way.
Both renting and owning in Juneau are expensive. The average single-family home costs more in Juneau than anywhere else in the state, and Juneau ranks fifth in the state for the highest average rental cost for a two-bedroom. The task force's goal is to assess the short-term rental market and make recommendations that improve housing availability. Mayor Beth Weldon handpicked the members of the group. She says despite the lack of renters, she believes the group can still make decisions that represent the various viewpoints of short-term rentals in town.
Are we missing the people that are going to come and say, I can't find rental places? Yes. But are we still counting for people there that want to regulate? I think that that's already represented.
She noted that she did ask a handful of people who were renters to join the task force, but they declined.
It's just, you know, quite honestly, when you do task force, it's hard to get all the voices, but keep the group a manageable group.
The task force has been meeting biweekly since January. They plan to host two public meetings in the coming months to get feedback from residents on what kind of regulations they'd like to see. Hughes-Scandies says it's important that people, specifically long-term renters, go to these meetings and make sure their voices are heard.
That is a real opportunity to be heard, and we would love to hear your thoughts on what you think we should do, how you think we should do it, you know, and if people have strong thoughts about the process, then we would love to learn from that.
Once the task force makes its recommendations, it will ultimately be up to the assembly to decide on how to implement them. If they pass regulations, Juneau wouldn't be the first community in Alaska to do so. Communities around the state have already taken steps to curb the increase in their markets. In Sitka, short-term rental owners are required to live on the property for half the year. And Wasilla only offers 75 short-term rental permits per year. Vacation destinations in states like Colorado have also put into place similar laws. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. Alaska Pacific University empowers students to make a positive difference in their communities through programs in education, business, outdoor studies, public health, and more. Scholarship and other financial aid opportunities are available. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu to automatically be considered for most scholarships. Advance your career and your community with APU today. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Just hours remain today for Alaskans to apply for a 2025 permanent fund dividend check. The deadline to apply at the state's website, pfd.alaska.gov, is 11:59 p.m. tonight. No form support is available due to the Seward's Day holiday. Mailed applications need to be postmarked by today, March 31st, to be processed. More than 600,000 Alaskans have already applied for a dividend, according to the state. The amount of this year's dividend is still up in the air as legislators craft a budget. Last year's dividend, including a one-time energy relief payment, was about $1,700. Sitka's oldest veterinary practice has closed its doors. Dr. Burgess Bowder retired on January 1st after 51 years serving Sitkins and their pets. That Bowder's practice was unusual is an understatement. In the first place, no one called him doctor, ever. He was a commercial cucumber driver and inspired thinker who built one of Sitka's most iconic landmarks, the Rockwell Lighthouse. He's regarded as a brilliant diagnostician who helped pet owners understand how illness developed and how to prevent it. Perhaps most unusual of all, his practice from the very beginning was free. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
I've been taking my dogs to Burgess for 35 years. He knows I'm not a cat man, and he's relishing this tete-a-tete we are having in his pet-filled living room.
I'm sorry about the cat. For those out there in the radio audience, Rob is tactfully trying to push away a cat that's trying to rub up against his face, and now she's going for the throat.
Burgess, and I should mention that Bowder is universally known simply as Burgess, like Cher or Zendaya, Burgess is sitting in a recliner with one of his rescued greyhounds curled in a dog bed nearby. The greyhound doesn't even lift his head when I come in. He must sense that Burgess is winding up to reminisce about his five-decade-old decision to undergo years of advanced medical training in veterinary school at the University of Washington and then give it away for free. It began in childhood.
I had a cat, Susie Bell, and I wanted to get her spayed. And I can remember the conversation with my dad when, you know, she kept having kittens. I had her from the time I was like 5 years old until I was in college. I had her almost 20 years, and she kept having kittens the whole damn time. And I said, Dad, can we get her spayed? And he said, Burgess, we can't afford it. It was $20 back in the 50s. By the time you pay the rent, pay the this, pay the that, buy the food. My mom was a nurse, but she, you know, she's paid employee and doesn't make that much. My dad was a truck driver. And I remember this. I said, well, when I'm a vet, I'm going to make it so people can afford it.
This is not Burgess's biography. That's already been written. It's called Animal Nature by John Straley, one of Alaska's most prolific novelists. I'll point you there for details about Burgess's early life, his career in collegiate football, and his life in veterinary medicine. Nor is this his obituary. We nearly had to write that in the mid-90s when Burgess lost a weight belt when diving for gooey ducks, became inverted, and more or less drowned in his diving helmet. His partner, Larry Traney, found him unconscious on the surface, resuscitated him, and a Coast Guard helicopter medevaced him to Juneau to recover in a hyperbaric chamber, which repressurizes divers who've come to the surface too quickly. Burgess claims to hold the local medevac record 6 times, which I see no need to dispute. But I digress. Burgess now is a hale and hearty 80-year-old, suffering from a slew of cardiac-related complaints common in this demographic. What he misses most are his regular dog walks. As far as regrets, there are none, except those that haunt every medical professional in a life and death situation. Difficult surgeries without the support of a vet tech or anesthetist are at the top of the list.
Anesthesia is months of boredom, interspersed with moments of stark terror. And if you look at the statistic for veterinary medicine, it's close to human medicine in that this is the downside. You ask for all of the warm fuzzies, but the downside is, you know, having an outcome that's something less than optimal. And the worst of that metric is death on the table. And it happens.
I've produced two previous news stories about Burgess. The first was 22 years ago when he was treed by a brown bear on Sitka's newly built cross trail. The bear, it turned out, had killed his old yellow lab Signet and cached the carcass near the trail. The second was some years later when Burgess castrated a pair of nearly grown brown bear cubs at Sitka's Fortress of the Bear visitor attraction. Whether this was revenge and whether it was sweet or merely served cold, Burgess did not say. Burgess is a living repository of stories of Sitka and its people. When prompted for just one story, he doesn't hesitate.
Christmas Eve, and the phone rings about 10:30 at night. And, hi, this is Mrs. Such and Such calling. And she said, my doggie's trying to have babies and can't. And I said, okay. I said, is there anything coming out? No. Oh, she's laying down and she's straining. I said, go to the clinic. And I said, bring along some troops. So she arrives at the clinic and she's got two daughters, herself and her dog. And I look at this thing and it looks like the Hindenburg. I couldn't believe it. I cut to the chase and I said, we're going to do a C-section here. And so this poor doggy could barely move. And I'm hoping it's not going to die. And we roll it up on the table. And I delivered 13 C-section puppies. The biggest C-section I've ever done in my life. Every one lived. And I'm handing these things out as I'm pulling them out of this bitch. Can I use the word bitch on the radio? Good. All right. And I'm handing these out. And we got all these screaming puppies. That is the sound of angels singing. God. Oh. But this little lady, she has one of these little clasper wallets like that, you know, with a little thing where you click it like that and keep dollar bills stuffed in there and coinage. And she pulls this thing out, unrehearsed, pops it open. She said, I don't have much, but I'd like to pay you for what you've done. And I said, it's Christmas Eve. It's yours. Take good care of them. And that was it. Oh, God, I love that story.
I can picture the grateful woman opening the coin purse. It evokes an era when coins were more dear than they seem now. The woman found good homes for all 13 puppies, and Burgess remembers not long ago putting one of the now elderly dogs down, a service he provided, like everything else, at no charge. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra, Liz Ruskin, Aliona Nidzin, and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Theo Greenlee in Alaska, Clarice Larson in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fight helped produce tonight's program. And I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years. Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
take the sky, for example, a canvas of a billion suns. But our local hero shines them out by day, save for the winking of a Venus or Mars. Even the stars sometimes fade to gray, even the stars hide away. Play the fool. I'll make my own way in the wide world. Just know I don't want to wander too far. Even the stars sometimes fade to gray. Even the stars hide away. Even the stars sometimes fade to gray. Even the stars hide away.
Still love. Yeah. Look at this face. I know the years are showing. Look at this life. I still don't know where it's going. I don't know much, but I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
Look at these eyes. They've never seen what matters. Look at these dreams. So big and so better. I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
So many questions still left unanswered. So much I've never broken through. I've ever known me and you. Look at this man, so blessed with inspiration. Look at this soul, still searching for salvation. I don't know much, but I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know.
Yes.